ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
You're listening to the Season 5 reboot of Breakdown, The MacGyver Murder Case, a podcast of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. For additional information, photos, videos, and documents relating to the MacGyver prosecution, please go to ajcbreakdown.com. Join our Breakdown Facebook group for continuing conversations about the case. And follow us on Twitter at ajcbreakdown and at ajccourts.
Previously on Breakdown.
I heard a big boom, and I didn't know what it was. I thought there was an explosion somewhere.
Once again, when you were talking with Detective Smith, you remember you told him, I'm sure he went to sleep with the gun in his hand. Remember telling Detective Smith that?
Tommy Lee is fast. Sir, let me just be plain. Danny is about to send me to prison. Please erase this voicemail message, but call me right away. Y'all have no idea the problem this is causing.
This is a case that may depend less on hard evidence than on hard feelings. As in, if the prosecution can prove to the jury that Tex MacGyver is a self-absorbed, conniving manipulator, it may not have to prove that he's a cold-blooded killer. Say the state can't quite make the case for murder, so it makes the case instead that the defendant is a thoroughgoing louse, and it sets the jury to thinking, this guy is capable of anything. Witness the emergence of the mysterious masseuse. Annie Anderson was seen at Tex's condo the day after Diane's death, giving Tex a massage in the master bedroom. Anderson was seen at the ranch a few days later, wearing boots that had belonged to Diane. The state has not offered proof, so far, that the relationship between Tex MacGyver and Annie Anderson was improper. All the state has done is show that Anderson is a boot borrower and a muscle kneader. That's kneader with a K. But witnesses can place Anderson alone with Tex in the days after Diane's death, and the state can stir in just enough nudge-nudge, wink-wink, to cast aspersions on Tex and Annie. Do I sense a pattern here? I'm Bill Rankin, legal affairs reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Welcome back to Breakdown. After 3 weeks of trial, it sometimes feels as if the state has a big pile of those kung fu throwing stars, and they just keep hurling them at Tex in the hope that at least a few of them will draw enough blood to put him down for the count. That's not to say that the prosecution has been ineffective or that Tex isn't a worthwhile target. And if the state comes up with more witnesses like Jay Grover, its position will be stronger still. Grover worked where Diane MacGyver was CEO. He knew her well. Well enough, in fact, to talk with authority about her flaws. This passage is kind of surprising. It doesn't necessarily sound like a motive for murder, but I expect the state will argue that it might have contributed.
Diane had an acerbic wit about her. I mean, she was a sharp tongue. She was tough on you. She picked at you a lot. She picked at me personally.
Did it ever get to the point that it was uncomfortable?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, she, just like she was in business, she was relentless. She would, it would go on and on. There were times when she'd start picking at somebody. And again, this is people that she knew, but she would just get on something and she would just go on. And I'd have to bite my tongue sometimes because it'd be very easy to kind of lash out, but then it would just keep on going from there. So it wasn't malicious to the point that it was necessarily mean-spirited, but it got to be quite annoying and aggravating.
Now, had you ever seen Diane MacGyver be that way with her husband, the way in which you have just described for the jurors?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Grover was Billy Corey's right-hand man. He's a former police officer, and his face became very expressive when he talked about the odd behavior Tex exhibited in the days after Diane's death.
I'm a vice president of special projects at the Corey Companies. U.S. Enterprises, probably better known as the Corey Companies.
Grover started working for Billy Corey when he was 15, pumping gas at one of Corey's gas stations. He called Diane a true friend, even though she was his boss. On the Tuesday after Diane's death, she died early on Monday, Grover drove Billy Corey over to the condo to talk to Danny Joe. They wanted the full story, which they hadn't gotten from Tex. Grover said that after Danny Joe had finished her account, Tex came into the room and sat down next to him.
The first thing that he did, he turned and looked over at me and said, Jay, can you believe they want to charge me with reckless conduct for this thing? And I was taken aback by that. I kind of stuttered and stammered, and I said, well, Tex, there's elements of a crime here. I was a former police officer, and so I think there's elements of a crime here. I was actually shocked that would be the first thing out of his mouth.
Tex's characterization of the shooting as, quote, this thing, unquote, surely was not lost on the jury. This is what I'm talking about. MacGyver says or does something to show that they didn't teach common sense or maybe common decency at his law school. Listen to what comes next. Grover said he returned to the condo that evening. It was full of Diane's friends, but he said he was immediately struck by the vibe in the room. It wasn't somber, and he didn't like it. He walked out and went downstairs. He saw Austin Schwall and a friend throwing a football. Tex was there too, talking on his cell phone. When he finished, he and Grover started talking.
He asked me if I knew anything about Social Security and Social Security checks. He said, well, I was just wondering about Diane's Social Security. And he went on to say, I was just wondering if I could collect her checks now. And I told him I didn't have any idea I could find out.
3 days after that, Grover said, Tex was talking about selling the expedition. By now, Grover had grown suspicious of Tex's behavior.
I was in my office, and he called me on my cell phone. I put it on the speakerphone, and I walked down while talking to him to Mr. Corey's office.
Corey was meeting with two other people. Grover said he motioned for them to be quiet and then laid the phone down on Corey's desk.
He said, I've got to run and see my lawyers. They want me to get down to their office and see them right away. He said they're jumping up and down, and they say that I...
And you're about to use a bad word, aren't you?
I was going to use a bad word.
I want you to say exactly what he said.
They said that I have f***ed up the case.
And did the defendant tell you how he had effed up the case?
I said, what's going on? And he said, this article is in the AJC. He said, this one with Bill Crane. He said, there's nothing wrong with the article. Bill and I vetted the article, and it's fine. I don't know what they're so upset about.
Tex, of course, was referring to the Black Lives Matter protester statement that spokesman Bill Crane gave to the media shortly after Diane's death. And Jay Grover is the one who brought up the boots. He gave them to Diane as a Christmas gift.
I actually had a morning breakfast meeting at a Cracker Barrel, and I saw these boots. As soon as I saw them, I said, that's Diane. And called her housekeeper to see exactly what size Diane wore. And then I bought those boots because they looked like Diane.
Grover testified that a week after the shooting, he saw masseuse Annie Anderson wearing those Cracker Barrel boots out at the ranch, and she was there alone with Tex. What are we to make of this? Well, the prosecution didn't tell us. They just wanted to drop the heavy hint that this other woman was trying on Diane MacIver's clothes a few days after Diane MacIver's death. Other than that, you're on your own. Monday morning, week 3. Juror 61. Late again. Great way to start the week. When she shows, Judge McBurney chides her for her repeated tardiness. He actually warns her that there could be a fine in store if she keeps it up. Then McBurney rises to share some news with the jury.
I have long prided our county in treating everyone equally. I want to show you what I got in the mail this weekend. So I will be doing my civic duty as well the coming weeks. The date is hopefully past the end of this trial, but you're not exempt from that. I don't know that I will be selected to be on a jury, but I'll have to go up to 7 and sit there and feel like I'm in a big cattle car and get moved to a courtroom and be harassed by a colleague. But all the names are in that big pool of ping pong balls, and they pull them out one at a time. They got McBurney. So, something for me to look forward to. I'll ask you guys what it's like.
The testimony by Billy Corey had been a highly anticipated moment of the trial. Corey, 86 years old, employed Diane MacIver for decades. He was a mentor, perhaps even a father figure, or an older brother. Corey appeared in court in a dark suit with an American flag lapel pin and a blue tie filled with U.S. flags. Corey started out 60 years ago with his first gas station, before there were convenience stores. Then, he owned convenience stores. Then, he branched out to billboards. He grew a business empire that included real estate, diesel fuel, vending companies, and video games.
She just grew with the business.
That's Corey testifying about the woman he'd hired 43 years before.
I got to thinking about it after this happened. She was more like a sister, a family. You know, she was with me every day, except Saturdays and Sundays, you know, most of her life. When she started there, I can remember, I think she was kind of timid and had pigtails, and she kind of got out of that stage of being timid, and she got more and more in charge. She finally promoted herself to president. I didn't have any official president. Well, Diane she was beautiful. She was smart, very smart. She was thorough. She was generous. She was compassionate. And she was shrewd.
Did she let people walk, over her, or all over her, which, when it came to business?
You said walk over her?
Yes.
No. If it needed to be, she could charm a bird out of a tree, but he better be careful if he's crossed her.
Corey described Diane and Texas' marriage as normal. But there was nothing ordinary about her love for Austin Schwall, her godson.
If Tex and I were in intensive care and Austin needs some toothpaste, she wouldn't think a thing about leaving us there.
Corey said Diane paid for Austin's schooling, bought clothes and toys for him, had a spare room for him at the ranch where they took him all the time.
What did Austin call Diane?
Call her Mama Di.
So is it fair to say that she loved Austin like he was her own child?
She couldn't love him anymore.
Corey said he learned Diane was dead the morning after the shooting. Tex called him and told him that Diane had been killed in a firearms accident. That's before Corey and Jay Grover drove over to the condo and met with Danny Joe to hear her describe exactly what happened in the expedition. We'll be right back.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
After both the state and the defense finished asking questions, the jurors had some. Here's Judge McBurney reading one of the questions.
Did you ever ask Mr. MacIver what happened in the vehicle that night?
No.
McBurney then asks Assistant DA Adam Abate if he has a follow-up question. He did. Why not? Abate asked. The tone of Corey's voice when he answers the question shows pretty clearly what he thinks of Tex now.
I figured if he wanted to tell me what happened to her, I knew what happened to her. He shot her in the back.
Ken Rickert is general counsel at Corey's company. Sometimes, Rickert said, he helped Diane with her personal legal matters, and he disclosed something we had not heard before, that Diane lent Tex $750,000 in March of 2005. He identified the promissory note documenting the loan. It was made before Tex and Diane were married. But Rickert said he didn't know why Diane lent Tex that huge sum of money. He also didn't know whether Tex paid off that loan, whether Diane had forgiven the loan, or whether Tex still owed the money on it. Rickert said he knew about the $350,000 loan that Diane gave to Tex for the renovation of the barn in 2011. That loan, documented in a promissory note, said Diane would get Tex's interest in the Putnam County Ranch if he defaulted. Tex only made interest payments on that, and Diane gave him a 3-year extension on it in late 2014. It's probably important to note that when Diane granted that extension, she added a clause that allowed her to foreclose on the loan at any time. And she reduced the interest rate a little bit, too. According to financial statements, Tex was paying Diane, on average, about $55,000 a year in interest payments for that loan. I know, that was an unusual marriage in that respect. The last time I asked my wife for a loan, well, I can't remember ever asking my wife for a loan. Rickert said he recalled that Diane and Tex had discussed changing their wills over the years. One of Diane's primary objectives for any update was to provide for Austin, her godson, Rickert said. During his testimony, Rickert said he became suspicious of Tex after stopping by to see him the Monday afternoon after Diane died.
I felt that I had to go buy condo and pay my respects. I had worked with Diane for 24 years and knew Tex and Diane for a long time. I was still in shock too, but I wanted to pay my respects to Tex.
Rickert said when he arrived, he found Tex on his cell phone, his back to him. When the call ended, Rickert said he tapped Tex on the shoulder and told him, "I'm so sorry." But Tex then asked him to go out into the lobby. As they walked outside, Tex had a question.
It was kind of a passing comment about Diane's Social Security, and I didn't even think about that. I said, I have no idea.
Tell the jurors what question he asked you.
As I recall, if he could get Diane's Social Security, something like that, any benefits. And I said, I don't know the text. I just called the Social Security office.
When they got into the lobby area by the elevators,
I expected that at that point in time he would tell me how sorry he was and how it was a terrible, tragic accident and say how much he loved Diane, but I never heard that. Tex next said that the firm was cutting him back and he was only bringing in $10,000 to $12,000 a month. And the ranch was costing him $20,000 to $25,000 a month to maintain, and that they were going to restructure things by the end of the year.
All of a sudden, a woman who lived on the floor appeared. She hugged Tex and told him how sorry she was.
I felt very uncomfortable at that point. It was an opportunity for me to leave. I pushed the elevator button and left the building.
Finally, Rickert acknowledged he may have something in common with Tex, if Tex indeed accidentally shot Diane in the back. Rickert has some firearms, including a semi-automatic handgun, a Sig Sauer P-238. About 2 years ago, he said he was cleaning the weapon in his home office downstairs in his basement.
Pulled the slide on it back. My finger obviously was inside the trigger. But I hit the trigger, and it discharged, went into a desk, my desk, and I was embarrassed. It was not something you like to have. I call it a negligent discharge. It was my fault.
Rickert said he had slight hearing loss in his left ear because of it. At least no one was injured, he said.
No, there was nobody around. I mean, it was pointed down. I would never point a loaded, or well, I thought it was unloaded. I didn't realize the round was in the chamber. I had the clip out. But even at that, I never point a gun at anyone.
The next witness left me, once again, wondering what sort of man Tex MacIver is. Angie Brooks had worked for Billy Corey for 36 years. She's now executive vice president. She, of course, knew Diane extremely well. She testified that she and Diane were both born in July. That meant they shared the same birthstone. Brooke said she really admired one piece of Diane's jewelry.
And it had a ruby and diamonds around it, and she's had it, the piece, for quite a while. And since both of our birthdays were in July, rubies were significant to both of us.
In her 2006 will, yes, that's the only one we know about, Diane made handwritten notations on the last few pages. She specifically left pieces of her jewelry to old friends. Assistant DA Kara Convery put up on the courtroom's overhead projector that page in Diane's will. She asked Brooks to read the items Diane left specifically for her.
Ruby and diamond ring, ruby and diamond bracelet, ruby and diamond earrings.
Convery then presented the book prepared by the auction house, listing all of Diane's belongings that Tex put up for sale. On three different pages, Convery got Brooks to identify the very three items Diane had left her, but had been put up for sale.
As you sit there today, have you received any of those items?
No.
I mean, Tex had asked for and received Diane's will just days after her death. He had the will. He knew what pieces of jewelry Diane had left her friends. Yet, he still put up for sale the three items Diane left for Brooks. What kind of person does something like that? And yes, when presented with the estate sale booklet, Angie Brooks looked empty, sad, mystified. But here's an example of a state's witness who wound up being a godsend for MacGyver's defense. Rachel Stiles said she once served as executive secretary to Ted Turner when he owned the Atlanta Braves. She worked for Billy Corey for 4 years and met Diane MacGyver at a company picnic.
I see this lady running around dressed very neatly and wearing a hat, and it was definitely obvious that she was in control. So I asked to meet her.
They became instant friends. She helped plan parties and events for Diane and eventually her wedding. The state wanted Stiles to testify because of a conversation she had with Diane about her will, sometime in late 2014 or early 2015.
She called me in her office and said, I need you to make some copies of these papers. She says, I cannot trust anyone else. So I proceed to the copy room and I make the copies and I went back and handed them to her. And she says, thank you so much. This is my new will.
Stiles said she didn't look at what she was copying, so she couldn't verify that the papers contained a will.
Well, when Diane said she could only trust me, there was no way I was going to betray her trust.
Here we go with this mysterious will again, a document the prosecution can't find. So this will, and who knows if it ever existed, supposedly provided Tex with a motive to kill Diane. The state has accused Tex of hiding the document, which is sort of like me accusing you of stealing my Jaguar, which I don't own, and then accusing you of hiding it away so I can't prove you stole it. You didn't, did you? So here's the godsend for the defense part. Stiles also talked about her firsthand observations of Tex and Diane's relationship.
Diane, for once, became a very happy person. They loved each other dearly.
They loved each other dearly for the entire time that you knew the two of them?
Absolutely.
And he always called her darling, didn't he?
That's correct.
Okay. Fair to say they were like two teenagers in love?
All the time.
Okay.
Stiles said the morning after Diane's death, Tex called her shortly after 6 a.m. to let her know.
And I said, what's up, Tex? And there was a pause, and he said, Diane is dead. Well, I started screaming.
Stiles said she soon went to the Buckhead condo, and when she first saw Tex, she said she saw something the prosecution says has been missing throughout this tragedy.
I first, went to Tex, and he gave me a hug and was just crying uncontrollably and could not talk.
Stiles said she spent the next 2 nights at the condo.
But he spent a lot of time in his bedroom and alone and several times when I would go in to check on him. He would be sobbing.
Tex's doctor, Dr. Hoos, had come to the condo. He asked Stiles to stay the night with Tex. He also asked her to hold on to his medication.
Dr. Hoos wanted me to make sure that I had control of it because of the state of mind of Tex. He was afraid that he might take more medication than he should.
And yes, Annie Anderson slept on the floor in Tex's bedroom those nights, Stiles said, although she admitted she didn't go inside and actually see that. But Stiles noted that Anderson was a masseuse for both Tex and Diane, as well as for Billy Corey. Anderson is not only married, her wedding reception was at Tex and Diane's ranch. Her husband, a personal trainer, was friends with Tex and Diane as well, Stiles said. Here's defense attorney Amanda Clark Palmer asking Stiles about the sleeping arrangements.
And you told us that you spent the night at Tex and Diane's condo those first two nights, correct?
Correct.
And Annie spent the night there as well, correct?
Correct.
And you said she slept in Tex's bedroom, correct?
Correct.
On the floor, correct?
That's what she said.
On like a, made up a little pallet that she slept on?
I believe so.
Fair to say she was also concerned about Tex's mental health and well-being?
Yes.
Abate follows up with a question of his own about that.
Dr. Palmer asked you about Miss Annie Anderson making a pallet, telling you that's where she slept. Did she also tell you that she was in the bed giving Mr. MacIver, the defendant, a massage, and that's where she slept that night?
No.
Okay. And this bedroom is the same bedroom that the defendant shared with his wife?
Correct.
We'll be right back.
It's the South's biggest deal for AJC podcast listeners. For a limited time, subscribe, and you'll get digital access to the AJC for $1.99 per week. For life, as long as you keep your subscription. That's our sports and politics coverage, breaking news and in-depth investigations, food and dining, and more from AJC.com every day for life. You'll also unlock access to our app, exclusive films, events, and newsletters. Subscribe now by going to AJC.com/start. That's AJC.com/start for new subscribers only.
Funeral director Wendy Edson prepared Diane MacIver's body for viewing and also handled the cremation. Tex, as you know, has taken quite a bit of heat for failing to fetch Diane's cremains. Was there a reason? Let's see. Edson said that Rachel Stiles and another woman arrived at the funeral home 2 days after the shooting to identify Diane's body. Edson asked Stiles to tell Tex that he could collect Diane's ashes on Thursday. Meanwhile, Tex sent a message to Edson regarding the urns he wanted. Diane's ashes were to be distributed among several urns, and then given to some of her friends. Tex told the funeral director he wanted something classic with a Western flair. When Tex arrived at the funeral home October 4th, he learned that he owed Edson $1,615 for the funeral and cremation services. Tex said, "Do I have to pay this today?" according to Edson. He said he wanted to pay the expense with money from Diane's estate. Edson told him that even if he didn't want to pay for Diane's cremains that day, he was still free to take them home. But he didn't. So who did pay for them? A witness for the state who turned out to be a bombshell witness for the defense, Kathy Johansson. Diane had hired her right out of college to work at the Corey Real Estate Company. They became fast friends. They were both single, and they played golf. But they had a falling out in 2008 or 2009. They were neighbors, lived in the same building in Buckhead, so they still saw each other.
We weren't friends anymore, but I loved her.
Even so, Johansson stands to benefit from Diane's will. Diane left her $100,000 and some jewelry. Johansson said she went to the first estate sale and found it very upsetting. She also learned later that Diane's remains were still at the crematory. So she and her sister made an anonymous payment to remove Diane's remains. They paid for it on October 22nd, cutting the check for $1,615.
It was a gift. It was private. No one needed to know. It was not to be known. In fact, I was angry that anybody learned that we paid. I didn't want anybody to know. I just wanted her out of there.
It was during cross-examination by Amanda Clark Palmer when Johansson dropped the bombshell. She said she has known Danny Joe Carter for 30 years, and she saw Danny Joe at Tex and Diane's condo the day after Diane died. Until then, she didn't know any details about her death, didn't even know there'd been a shooting. She said she talked to Danny Joe in the entertainment part of the condo.
You go in and you talk to Danny Joe, and she tells you what happened.
right?
Yes.
So Danny Joe told you that when they were driving on, when they were driving in the car, she told you that Tex had fallen asleep and that Diane said something like, "Tex, wake up, Tex, wake up," right before, boom, the gunshot happened, correct?
She told me that she said that Diane said, "Tex, wake up. Don't go to sleep. You won't sleep tonight." Boom. Gun goes off.
She said that those two things happened like back to back.
Yes. Don't go to sleep. You won't wake. You won't be able to sleep tonight.
Thank
wake
you.
Up. Tex, wake up. You won't sleep tonight. Boom. And Diane said, "Tex, what did you do? I've been shot."
And this is what Danny Joe Carter told you?
Correct.
Monday morning?
Correct.
Okay.
Before this trial began, I hoped that the state would finally tell us once and for all whether Diane executed a second will. And if so, would that provide the motive for murder that prosecutors claimed it would show? Well, Ken Rickert, who we heard from before, never prepared a new will for her. So, we're now 3 weeks into this trial, and I still have no answers to those questions about the will. And I'm now wondering, why is the prosecution making such an issue out of it? One other person who would have been able to shed light on all this was estate attorney Harold Hudson. Hudson testified that he sat down with Tex and Diane years ago to work out new wills for the two of them. Did he draw up a new final will and testament for Diane?
My recollection is no, we never completed new wills for Tex and Diane MacGyver.
Even though they met about it and exchanged emails about it, Hudson said, there may have been a simple reason the wills were never finished.
Sometimes doing people's wills is like trying to sell them life insurance. It's really not up on the fun list of things to do. And I find in almost 30 years of practice in law, I find it can sometimes be difficult to get people to come in and go over these issues. I was telling somebody the other day, it's most people, when they describe, when you start talking about their wills, they say, "Now, if I die," I'm like, "What? If you die, you're going to die. It's just a matter if you come to grips with it." So I find that for some people, it's not a fun task to do. Tex and Diane appear to be very, very, very busy people, flying all over the place, having business meetings. And so getting them to come back and go over these issues was exceedingly difficult.
Hudson said there were a lot of appointments that were made and then canceled. Prosecutor Clint Ruckert took Hudson through a drawn-out examination, one that had Hudson looking alternately pained or bored to tears. Except, however, when Rucker asked Hudson about what documents he had and which documents he didn't have, it appeared that Rucker was insinuating that maybe there was a new will. He noted that in a document holder found in Hudson's basement was an empty folder labeled, quote, LWT Diane, unquote, Diane's last will and testament. Hudson ultimately said he could find nothing in his records or emails that showed he drew up new wills for Tex and Diane. And I'd think if there was a new will, there'd be emails asking for the couple to come to the law office to sign the wills or something like that. Or, here's the final draft of what you agreed upon. Please look over it closely before you sign it. DA's investigators downloaded the contents of Hudson's computer during a search of his office. They came up with nothing. Yet, Rucker kept insinuating that there must have been a new will.
Were there any discussions with you about whether or not you had a new will for Diane MacGyver?
Absolutely not.
Do you have a new will for Diane MacGyver?
Absolutely not.
Defense attorney Amanda Clark Palmer followed up.
You never destroyed a new will of Diane MacGyver's, right?
No.
Much of the week was spent with experts, a real estate attorney, an estates and wills law professor, an accountant. But there was also one other witness I have to tell you about. It was Nicole Carroll from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation's Crime Lab. She testified that swabs were taken from the .38 Smith & Wesson that fired the bullet that killed Diane. but the lab couldn't find any DNA on the gun to match Tex's DNA. Made me wonder, could this be the first case in history in which the state calls a crime lab expert to testify that a defendant who admits to shooting his wife did not leave his DNA on the gun everyone agrees was used in the shooting? Okay, the accountant, Francis Dean Driscoll III. He said Tex's financial position was worsening significantly from 2013 to the day of Diane's death, 2013 being the last year Tex was an equity partner at his law firm. Tex's salary at his law firm was $395,000 that year. It dropped to $134,000 during the first 9 months of 2016, Driscoll noted. Driscoll went through Tex's financial situation using a PowerPoint presentation on a big screen that was carted in front of the jury. It went into minute detail about Tex's finances. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? The last thing I would want is to have my finances revealed like that on such a public stage. But Tex had to sit there and look at it. By 2016, Tex had far more money going out than coming in, Driscoll said. No surprise, much of that had to do with the expenses at the ranch. Driscoll also said that upon Diane's death, Tex's financial standing had improved from a net worth of $1.7 million to almost $6 million. But during a lengthy cross-examination, defense attorney Amanda Clark Palmer tried to show the jury that, because Diane was the breadwinner, Tex would have been better off financially with Diane alive than dead. Last Wednesday was Arsenal Day. During a break, a table was put in the courtroom in front of the jury box. Investigators then piled about 40 rifles and handguns taken from Tex's ranch and condo. The haul included several .38 Smith & Wesson revolvers taken from Tex. It was quite a display. And to see a photo of it, please go to our website, ajcbreakdown.com. And this was effective. The prosecution got permission to play to the jury snippets of interviews Tex gave to two local TV news stations. Here's one he gave to WSB-TV.
Guns are not my thing. There were some theories that this had been done because of my need for her money and so on. It's just not the case. As it turns out, she was very, very successful in her own right, coming the way she did, but I was more.
Guns aren't my thing? Seriously? The guy who owned dozens of firearms and could throw a bottle into the air and shoot it before it came down? And did you hear him bragging about being more successful than Diane? Please. But defense attorney Bruce Harvey seemed to score a point when he questioned DA investigator Brian Salters. Salters was used by the prosecution to put into evidence all the guns found at the ranch and during a search of the McIvers Buckhead condo.
In your search of the condominium, you were thorough, right?
Yes, sir.
And you searched every place you could think of?
I did, yes, sir.
Or that was obvious and visual, or visible, or not even obvious and visible, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, there was no will, right?
I did not find a will.
I've said from the get-go that perhaps the strongest pieces of evidence in this case are, one, that Tex pulled the trigger of the .38 Smith & Wesson and shot and killed Diane in the back, and, two, that if the gun wasn't cocked, it took a little more than 12 pounds of pressure to pull the trigger. The state called upon Zach Weitzel of the GBI Crime Lab. He specializes in firearms. He took out the .38 Special, he stood before the jury, and showed how it works.
The only way that the gun will fire is if the trigger is pulled and then held to the rear long enough for the hammer to fall. Because you notice the trigger.
When Wetzel did this, it all got very real. Here was the gun. There were the clicks. During the demonstration, Tex sat at the defense table weeping and often shielding his face with one hand. Wetzel was knowledgeable, confident, and articulate on the stand. We'll explore his testimony in greater detail in Episode 9, and we'll talk about something totally unexpected that occurred toward the end of his time on the stand. Next, on Breakdown.
Mr. Walker went through these things with you, and he went through these things in detail, but you know what he's saying? He's saying you did a crummy job. That's what he's saying. You didn't investigate it right. So I'm going through these things with you because you did investigate it right, didn't you?
So don't answer that question.
Breakdown is reported and narrated by Bill Rankin, produced by Richard Hallix. Sound design by Chris Basta of Bare Knuckles Creative in Atlanta. Original music composed and performed by Bo Emerson, Billy Guin, and Chris Basta. Special thanks to Bert Roten, who lit the fire that became Breakdown. Special thanks as well to the AJC's editor-in-chief and podcaster, Kevin Riley, to Pete Corson, Monica Richardson, Mark Wallagor, and all the fine folks at the Journal Constitution, plus Chris Basta and Chris Nicholson, a.k.a. C1 and C2, Buddy Hall, Josh Gaynor, and our good friends at WSB-TV and radio.
Hello, this is a collect call from
Tex MacIver,
an inmate at
Fulton County Jail.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at AJC.com/hip-hop.